What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower. Now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Family Secrets is a production of iHeartRadio.
Only recently did my father, Larry, appear in a dream. We were together in a small harbor crowded with sailboats tied one to the other in a web of lines, hopping from one deck to the next. Despite their jostling by waves, the hulls didn't bump. The water sounded alive. Proud that I would finally take up ocean sailing, my father wanted to help me choose the best boat. His words of encouragement were brief, but his smile was ripe with paternal love. Perhaps the imprint of my parents exists in the truthful tale of my genes, the color of my hair, my mother's dark brows, my Conover wide smile, my father's easy laugh, my small muscled body that loves to dance a wild streak as I'm told my mother did. And two, whatever I experienced as an infant must also be within me, the tethered gaze between my mother and me, her voice that I surely recognized straight from the womb, my father's touch as he stroked the tiny wings of my shoulder blades, the smell of my parents, the taste of her milk, my primal known world.
That's Sarah Conover, author of the recent memoir, Set Adrift. Sarah's is the story of a family tragedy that occurred when she was a very young child. So young, in fact, that she has no memory of it. She's left with a lifetime of questions, of longing, and of the profound desire to understand all that has been lost. What can we piece together, even when the pieces have been shattered beyond recognition? I'm Dani Shapiro, and this is Family Secrets, the secrets that are kept from us, the secrets we keep from others, and the secrets we keep from ourselves.
It's kind of a complicated map, my childhood. So my parents and grandparents vanished on January 8th, 1958. My grandfather spent a lot of winters down in the tropics sailing. He was one of the most trophied ocean racing yachtsmen of his time. Commodore of the Cruising Club of America, publisher of Boating Industry, on the board of Yachting Magazine. And my father was a contender for the Olympic trials. And they had invited my parents down, my grandfather and grandmother, to join them right after Christmas. January 1st, 1958 is when they left the Florida Keys, headed ostensibly to Miami, but actually by way of the Bahamas. And they ran into the worst unpredicted storm in the Miami Weather Bureau's history at that time, where the day started out as, you know, light breezes expected. And then, like within 6 hours, there was 70 mile an hour winds and 40 foot waves. Many boats foundered, many. And my family's boat was the only one that didn't return. And because of my grandfather's renown in the yachting and business worlds, it was probably one of the most extensive private searches, private and public searches of the time. The Navy, the Coast Guard, the Cuban Navy, all sorts. They combed 24,000 square miles looking for them, truly needle in a haystack. And one of the problems was that the weather stayed stormy for a number of days. They were reported missing on a Saturday, and the search couldn't start till a Tuesday. And that might have been the only window where they could have been saved. They were seen by a fishing boat 19 hours after the storm, almost capsized. Five people hanging off the lines, what are called drogues, by the end of the boat, sea anchors. But the boat that saw them was also foundered. Their motor had cut out. So there was a search that went on for quite a bit. And the dinghy of the boat, the kind of the little lifeboat, washed ashore on north of Miami, about 80 miles, 5 days later or so. And nothing else was found. Pieces were put together of maybe what happened, but really, you know, 40, 45 foot waves, 70 mile an hour winds, it tells a lot. And there might have been a mechanical failure on the boat. We don't know.
You were 18 months old. Your sister Eileen was almost three. At what point did you have any sense of anything about this story, of knowing that you had lost your parents?
It's a funny question because, you know, back then, with Dr. Spock era, you don't talk to kids about these kind of things, right? They can't understand it. Really, adults can't understand it either. So my sister, who was older, she was the one who was told, my grandmother said your parents are dead. And I know my grandmother must have said it a number of times, but this is the weird thing about early childhood loss, is one of the things you mourn is that you just know your world vanished, and you don't have those stages of recognizing cognitively, oh, I lost my parents. You know, it was almost pre-verbal and all that. So you don't have those stages of grief. There was no cognitive way to recognize it. My sister she remembers people coming into her room, and she was in her crib, and it was like a big black cloud that came over the whole everything. The world just stopped.
But after the world stops, it also must go on. When Sarah and her sister are orphaned by this mysterious boating accident, they're sent to live with their aunt, their father's sister, Fran, and her husband, who have two children of their own. But Sarah and Eileen's maternal grandmother puts up a fight, a long fight. A custody battle persists for 10 years, during which Sarah and Eileen are required to see their grandmother every other weekend. The atmosphere in their aunt's home and their grandmother's could not be more different.
She was the one who was fighting for custody for a decade and filled me with vitriol about the family with majority custody. They aren't your real family. Those aren't your parents. You're not one of them. My father's sister's family, the way they had to respond to the grief was Fran, my father's sister, couldn't talk about the accident at all. She lost her favorite brother. She lost her hero, her mother, her father. She just couldn't talk about it. So there was one family that just couldn't talk about it and wouldn't, despite all the sailing trophies in the hutch. And then the other family, the other one fighting for custody, would only talk about it and would say that those Conovers, they killed my daughter.
You have this phrase in your book that really struck me, which was that you were schooled in dissociation and numbness. And you know, we've talked a lot about dissociation on this podcast as sometimes a healthy defense mechanism to some degree, you know, that protects us until we don't need protecting. Obviously, it can also be unhealthy. I mean, one of the things that also really strikes me is the way that, and you, as so many kids in that era in particular, where there was a tragedy in a family or something difficult in a family, were left to piece it together for
themselves, right? And, you know, in a way, you're dissociating, but at the same time, you're working overtime to try to piece it together between what your grandmother, who you don't really trust, is saying to you and what your adoptive parents who are raising you are saying or not saying to you, because they don't really want to talk about it, especially Fran.
Yeah. One of the tragic things is that the family that had majority custody was really blown apart. And Fran, my mother there, just, you know, she had four kids and she just couldn't give me the attention that my grandmother could. And so, you know, in certain ways, I gravitated like, oh, this person could give me all the attention I need. And my sister and I, we would visit my grandmother, and she was a rather an amazing artist and had oil paintings that she'd done of my mother and had professional photographs of my mother, no Conovers, but of my mother, all over her house in Connecticut. And she moved from Fresno to be close to us and to try to wrest us from the other family. And the weird thing was, you know, there were pictures of her mother all over the house, but it was that era where people didn't smile in photographs. And my sister and I were like, that's our mother? I mean, you did not want to attach to these photographs. And it just did not really compute that this could be our mother. My grandmother was complicated and fascinating too. You know, she lost her mother and her sister in the 1918 flu. So she had a tragedy behind her. And I think her losing her daughter just sent her over the edge. And she would do anything to get custody of us.
Why was she so against your aunt and uncle who became your adoptive parents?
I think it was existential for her. And she was a bit of a kooky character. She was always weirdly ended up as a single, not weirdly, I think very intentionally ended up as a single parent and married in the end about five times. And she had sort of amazing perseverance and as a single mom, but she would divorce whatever guy she got married to pretty fast.
And your mother was her only child?
No, she also had a son by a different father. And that one, she kept her son, Lane, very close in ways that, you know, I'm sure could be psychologized very easily in terms of Oedipus something. You know, he never got his own career. She always supported him. He was actually very, very smart guy and a great flamenco guitar player, but she kept him close. And I think it was existential for her after losing her daughter that she didn't lose him. So in a way, she made everybody's life miserable between the two families. And on another hand, she taught me to see beauty. And in some ways, she really saved my life. She would set up an easel for both my sister and I and a beautiful still life on her breakfast table. The weekends we were with her and teach us to paint watercolor and oil colors. And she played the piano and danced. She would let us have the run of the house, and that was pretty fun.
She also didn't want you to call her grandma, right?
Right. So that was another thing. So she had us call me mère, which means mother in French. We did not know that. And it also, ironically, means the sea in French.
We'll be right back.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. With a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain.
With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Memory is such a puzzle. We need witnesses, especially in circumstances like Sarah's. As she writes, orphans not only lose their parents, but also the historians of their early years. And in Sarah's case, she's on the receiving end of contradictory stories from her aunt and her grandmother. So pieces of the story, of the truth, come to her over time like bits of buried treasure. She begins to be able to assemble, little by little, the truth of who she is and where she belongs.
There's different stages where you can think, oh, no, wait a minute. Wait, I look like her. But when you're little, you're just trying to land somewhere. And the whole family, everybody was set adrift by this accident. And where do I belong? I think orphans have the ability to, you know, they're kind of a desperate figure, but they also can remake themselves. And at some point, I just decided that's what I'm going to do. I watched the Sound of Music probably 20 times and, you know, decided that mountains weren't going to be my thing. I just couldn't go near the water. And so completely left the whole sailing business behind, and pretty young went out to Rocky Mountains and took a mountaineering course. And, you know, I was probably maybe 17 or 18 when I walked across Switzerland by myself after having watched The Sound of Music, not realizing that that movie was in Austria, thinking it was in Switzerland. But I orphaned myself. I orphaned the grief. And, you know, it seemed okay. I was restless. But I also looked around me and I saw alcoholism. You know, by the time I was a teenager, my sister Eileen, the other orphan, she had really disengaged from my grandmother. And my grandmother had shown me a lot of favoritism by then. And so that wasn't really a refuge anymore at all. And I couldn't trust my grandmother then either. You know, my father's siblings, except for Fran, really dove into alcohol and very troubled lives, and that nobody would talk about the elephant in the living room. You know, I understand that that generation, the greatest generation, they had no tools. Nobody was talking about post-traumatic anything. Nobody knew what to do with grief. So I understand it now, but, you know, I had that group not talking about it, and the other group who was so skewed, my grandmother, that I just thought, nobody's telling the truth here, and I need to know. I need truth. There has to be some authenticity. So at a very young age, I became a religious seeker. At first, it was through nature. When I was walking through Switzerland, I happened to walk into the tent where the great Indian Saint Krishnamurti was teaching, of all people. And that started to open other doors. And I became a religious studies major. Fran used to call me the biggest why kid she ever met. And I think I've been asking, you know, what is the question we've been asking our whole lives? One of them is why? Why and what? And are we loved and by whom? And so there was a lot of why for me. Why? And where is truth? Where's our foundation? I left home when I was 17. I graduated early from high school. Went out west, went to a commune, but, you know, along with the hippie era, there was a lot of spiritual banqueting around as well. And I guess religious studies certainly gave me a view of it, and I had to just keep searching. There was a time when I was hiking in Nepal, and I was hiking by myself. I was trekking in Nepal, and a Tibetan monk came in the opposite direction and smiled at me in a way that I'd never seen a human being smile in my life. And this was right before college, and I felt like, okay, that is my compass, whatever that is, that's my compass.
I can so picture that encounter with the monk on the path. I can picture that smile. I can just see it. And, you know, I wonder, I mean, you were on the one hand trying to stay ahead of what was haunting you as you were making these treks and these trips and searching for something that you weren't sure what you were searching for. You quote the Buddhist psychologist Tara Brach as saying that trauma is severed belonging. And that really, really struck me. It struck me as a deep truth. And it seems that your sense of belonging was ripped away from you as an 18-month-old. And if that's your story, then it would seem that life becomes, to some degree, at some point, about finding a way for that belonging to become whole.
Yeah. And I do think that's what, you know, sometimes I call it the mother hole, but it could be the God hole. It could be what makes us feel whole. I think orphans is a noun and a verb. We are orphans, but we are also orphan others, that, you know, as a protective mechanism. And it gets mixed up with that horrible thing of, you know, independence in American culture. But we orphan ourselves from one another. And yes, the need for belonging is so fundamental. And I was looking for that, whether spiritual, nature, I was looking so hard for that. I was looking for bedrock. So I decided the Gagnes, my eventually adoptive family. I'd already been told by my grandmother forever, they're not really your family. And, you know, your name is Sarah Conover and they're Gagne, even though I grew up as a Gagne. I think that I just was looking hard and working hard for that sense of belonging. What do I belong to? What do we all belong to, which is our bedrock?
How old were you when you changed your name back to Conover?
Yeah, I was in my early 20s. When I moved out west, it kind of like, okay, I'm just going to do the whole thing. I'm going to take my birth name, my beautiful birth name back. And I left the Gagnes. They're all back on the East Coast. And I'm my own self here. And there we go. I'm going to just take that name back. And like, you know, putting them all in a bottle in the sea, like goodbye. And of course, we can't do that. Of course, we can't do that. So my biological sister still has the last name, Eileen Gagne. And my other siblings kept that name. But they were my, I don't know what you call them, my step-siblings.
Well, and they were your cousins.
They were my cousins. They were my first cousins, yeah.
As often happens when we open one door, other doors open too. Sarah changes her name back to the name she was born with. And she also meets her future husband, Doug. She's studying to become an Aikido, a Japanese martial arts instructor in Boulder, Colorado. Doug is practicing martial arts too. They have shared interests and an immediate connection. They get married within a couple of years. They move to California to start a family. Things seem to be going smoothly for Sarah. She feels far from her childhood, which had been defined by secrecy, tragedy, and grief. But her grief returns and reverberates, because that's what grief does.
I was still running hard ahead of the grief, I think, and numb, and pretty excited about, you know, a new baby. And I think the first big wake-up call was that when my, you know, there's that book, Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score. I also think the body keeps the clock. And at 18 months, I only put this together about 6 months ago, Danny. 18 months is when I started not to be able to sleep.
When your son was 18 months old?
Yeah, when he was 18 months old, that's when sleep got very challenging for me. And later on, I realized we left California. We left, and Fran had moved to California. We decided all to move there together. You know, I'll move there. Let's do it at the same time. Her second husband had family there. And I put this also together about 6 months ago, is that when my daughter turned 18 months old, I also left Fran behind and moved up to Washington State from California. Even though I had told people in California, I had said, I finally have the mommy I've been looking for. Fran was there all the time for us. It was a beautiful thing. And yet, I wanted to move back to the mountains, my safe place.
As Sarah enters midlife, she can no longer outrun her grief. She sinks into a depression that seems, on the surface of things, at odds with the beautiful life she has created with her family in this beautiful place.
It's one other thing I wanted to say about orphaning. Being an orphan and orphaning others and orphaning yourself, orphaning your own feelings from yourself. I orphaned my grief. When I looked up, you know, secrets, as in family secrets, it also means to separate. I really kind of thought about that, to separate.
Surely it does that.
Yeah, and all of this, I mean, there was just separation and secretivity everywhere. The ocean secreted my parents away. People secreted their guilt, their grief. We separated ourselves. I mean, I think that was the biggest tragedy of this, is that it didn't bring, you know, grief to heal has to bring a community together. It blew us apart till recently, really, until my book was done. And we could kind of all see the map of the grief, because grief can be horizonless, kind of like the sea. And for my sibs to see their pain on the page and my pain, we could finally drop it. But meanwhile, we just separated from each other and kept orphaning ourselves from one another.
Well, in the process of writing your book, you do a lot of research, but part of the story are the interviews that you do with your siblings, with Eileen and with your two cousins slash siblings. You grew up with them all of your remembered childhood, and you give them really space and a chance in your book to allow for their own feelings and their own reality, which is, I would imagine, part of what ended up being so healing about the book for all of you.
Yeah, that's one of the things I recommend to everybody, is interview your siblings. And, you know, those big touchstones in your family history, how did they experience it? Because you will learn a lot, and it just diminishes any self-involvement because everybody else around you is suffering as well. I think it's a really important thing to do. We are meaning makers as we go through life. We're story makers, and stories can also use us. And the fact that this tragedy blew our family apart meant that people were making up stories about each other. And if you ask any dysfunctional, you know, anybody who's not getting along with somebody in their family, they have a story about that other person. So we had these stories about each other that couldn't get underneath the pain. And that's why I think interviewing your family is so important. But stories can be so dangerous. They're important when they work for you, when they work for another person. But boy, and we've all experienced this thing where somebody tells you just a little something about somebody you haven't met. By the time you meet that person, it's tainted already. And this is like a hundredfold with your family. So it's the unwriting of the fictions that we have about each other. And I also felt like I had to unwrite my own fiction. First I was Sarah Conover, and then I grew up as Leslie Gagné. And then I wanted to drop the Leslie Gagné because she had had this kind of chaotic childhood. And so I became Sarah Conover. But those things are all inside you. So all of that for me had to get untangled, and I had to unwrite those fictions as well.
58 years after the accident, after the vanishing, Sarah's sister Eileen has the idea that the family should come together for a proper memorial to honor their parents and grandparents.
I had asked Fran, why didn't you have a memorial? I mean, they had been finally declared dead by the insurance company. And she said, we just thought we'd discover them on a deserted island in the Caribbean. I mean, I kind of blamed Gilligan's Island for this or something, you know? But also, that generation didn't have the tools to say, what are the constellations of grief? You know, it's not just sadness, it's all this other stuff. And she had to bunker her own grief. So we, 58 years after, my sister and I held a memorial, and it was beautiful. And Fran was there, and my cousins / siblings I grew up with, the two, they didn't come out for it. But Fran really stood tall. And we had a memorial bench made saying, Pops and Gan, Larry and Lori, sail on. And looking at Golden Gardens out on Puget Sound, there just happened to be a sailing regatta going on with the boats, the horns coming off the I forget what you call those boats. And a beautiful, beautiful day. And it was lovely to hear Fran talk about what a gift we had been when she lost her parents, that she was able to adopt us and to raise us. And yeah, there was finally some closure around that.
Here's Sarah reading one last passage from her powerful and probing memoir.
Orphan. Every year I pass the moment when the sea held and turned you, when exhausted you surrendered. You lie in wool, silks, and taffetas, heavy with water, at the bottom of my cedar trunk. You hang on the wall crooked, chipped, waiting to be straightened. How surprised I am at your faces growing into my son and daughter. Perhaps you are coming back to me now, given back by the ocean in the bits left on the sand. You wash ashore and I pick through the sea rack, lifting shells to my ear and listening, fingering the sea scour and colored beach glass, resting the fragile carapaces of the long dead in my palm. Little nothings to anyone else, but we know better. Blood is our private sea, my covenant with the two of you, my parents. Remembering you, I won't throw anything back.
Family Secrets is a production of iHeartRadio. Molly Zakur is the story editor, and Dylan Fagan is the executive producer. If you have a family secret you'd like to share, please leave us a voicemail, and your story could appear on an upcoming episode. Our number is 1-888-SECRET-0. That's the number 0. You can also find me on Instagram at Danny Writer. And if you'd like to know more about the story that inspired this podcast, check out my memoir, Inheritance.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th, hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.